Well, that's a great segue. I mean, because we're at the final session, and what we're going to try to do here is to learn, pull our understanding and set certain kind of priorities of potential future research, collaborations, certain things that have surfaced in the conversation, so a shared understanding of what some priorities might be. And so I would definitely like to get people's input on what they think sort of next steps, what kind of research, what kind of issues need to be dealt with. And so we can focus on attention. So do this.
Well, I mean, kind of taking off from what you just said and what John just mentioned, I strongly believe, as you probably have been saying already, that the currency is a key issue that we need to focus on, and not just because of the currency. That when you look at the impact on developing economies, I think it even makes it much more urgent and present for me personally, and I hope everybody in the room feels the same way, because again, when I look at the past, you know, we've done all kinds of things, those yeah. never empower and sustain the environment. If we are looking for global prosperity and developing economies need to participate in that, this is the opportunity. We have converging technologies that we can use on the practical level to make it happen. And this is
Let me just follow up. So the proposal being, in a sense, to come in and answer test graphs, have a workshop around this, but also there may be some kind of project that we're going to say, and we target to a mobile platform and pull together a framework on how to think about this. And sort of mobilize different kind of expertise in designing new kind of currencies, and but also take an inventory of what's being done. So I think part of the thing is, because there's so many things that are going out there, and so what if we can approach this in a really well-informed way, we might say have another workshop, and then that may lead to some kind of collaborative project where we actually build something.
One thing I would just add into that is just, as a part of that experiment, is to actually handle the conversion into some currently acceptable form. Because I think at the point that you do the exchange is where you find these friction points that drive the current economy. And without that, it's very theoretical. So I mean, it's just like when you go after and you sort of think about the credit card processors, it's all fine to talk about all these different alternative schemes, but at some point you have to convert it to dollars. And in order to do that, you have to have a credit card, you have to have a cashier's check that you take into a bank, or at some point, and that's why...
That's the PayPal problem.
Yeah, that's right. The PayPal problem.
They can't unhook that to then do a bunch of other
right.
stuff.
And so that's the reason that these natural friction points remain, and if you look at payments profit pool, that's the reason that profit pool is so large, because there's so much inherent friction in there. Same thing.
Can you elaborate? I'm fully understand. I mean, you're saying that they won't accept. You create all these alternative currencies, but then they won't accept them for a conversion.
Or they can, in essence, put you out of business because they can make the conversion rate across so high that.
So how would you intervene in order to reduce? What would be the alternative? I mean, is it a legal mechanism or a competing mechanism? What would be the alternative?
Well, I think if I'm understanding that correctly, basically, if we just take one. Let's look at one sector, you know, and I will use an example I'm familiar with. Let's say you take any one of the African countries or whatever, wherever it may be, catalog the goods, cows, whatever it may be, and we convert that to a single denominator as a starting point. If we can make that successful, then building multiple becomes an easier case because we would have learned from all the challenges, you know, that we will find within that pilot concept.
Okay.
I mean, Jeff, is that?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. The other thing is there's huge spreads between wholesale and retail. And so let's say that, you know, so you take a person with a credit card paying 20% and the bank's getting it for like 1%.
Right.
And, you know, that's in extreme, right? But, and then if you add corruption on top, I mean, I don't know what the cost of capital in Somalia is, but it's got to be over 100% per year.
We probably want that to spend that by.
Yeah.
Okay. Do we have some other suggestions?
What about since currencies are, you need more than one person to have a currency.
Absolutely.
So you need institutions of some sort. I mean, I guess that's what you were alluding to, Jeff. When you think about what would be the equivalent of banks in a different currency world? for, I mean, because borrowing is certainly something that's, that people need to do from time to time. There are provisions, for example, in this new energy bill for borrowing future allocations of CO2. So there are people going to be banking, there's going to be banking functions, trading functions, and, you know, commodity futures, regulation and so forth of CO2. But, you know, those may or may not be sufficient in terms of the institutions that are needed if CO2 becomes, well, does CO2 become an asset class or does it become a currency? And what exactly is the difference?
Well, I think one way to think about it is it cheap enough to put it into money? Does money capture all the dimensions of value to the community of interest? Because it becomes a currency if the conversion, if the conversion denudes it of certain dimensions that are valuable, or the cost of conversion into it costs a lot of money, then you'll just trade, you'll barter in a sense. Mm-hmm. Like you'll barter with, you'll do efficient barter, which is what currency is.
I'd just add on to that, John, is just some notion of, you know, and whether it's in the study of currency or something else, is some notion of the value of your identity, so the value of all the collective information around you. And maybe that is as a currency, maybe it's as a social currency or it's an identity currency. You know, it's your GPA and it's your degrees and it's, you know, all the different aspects that make up who you are. It's your driver's license, it's the fact that you don't have any DWIs, you know, it's all those type of things. So maybe just a thought of incorporating that currency discussion with the identity side.
Well, this comes up to a conversation I had with Sandy before he left, because he had to help his wife at home, and was saying, well, what things that he think would be important to follow up on, and it struck me that there was a consensus out of the group that how do you deal with this whole question of rich data that he discussed, and how do you create a trusted third party or parties, and how is that handled? And so as part of that, I think you're saying, okay, if you look at identity as a key component of that rich identity, and people, there's information being collected on you, so your social graph is your signature, and you make markets out of it. I mean, it strikes me there's all sorts of challenges around the kind of institutional forms. Is it going to be a digital institution with member-owned? How do you have certain provisions and protections? I mean, how do we get our, I mean, that struck me as one of the findings of this group, is it's recognizing that we're moving in a direction where this is becoming important. And there's no traditional, the current regulatory conceptual legal framework is not really well suited to dealing with
it. So I understand it maybe in three ways. Summing what you just said, so identity, okay. I think is, without that, you can't have accountability, transparency. Right. There's lots of stuff, right? You can't authenticate credibility. There's so much stuff that can't be done. So that's sort of an enabling sort of precursor to almost anything, right, beyond right. that. And then certainly the currency, but I see sort of the currency in the abstract, most in the way that you put it forth, is kind of the prescriptive, embodied, quantitative aspects of the agreed upon or pre-negotiated sort of interaction, right, between individuals or individuals in institutions or groups within groups, right? Then there's a third aspect, which is this sort of qualitative aspects that have to be described that govern the system that I think we need to figure out how the system embodies those qualitative aspects, right? Anything that we believe is sort of behaviors that we think are the cultural norms that we want to reinforce, right? Or the policies that we want to set forth, or the laws.
Are you thinking governance mechanisms?
Governance, it could be laws, it could be, governance, and then those things that are connected to actual laws, right? So the system itself embodies the laws so that there is no, so it basically the system itself enforces its own kind of integrity.
Part of the discussion was that you may have a competitive regimes in order to explore, invent in different kind of rule sets. And out of that would come genuine innovation as to what might be the most appropriate governance mechanism for different.
I'm saying something slightly different, okay. Which is there are the rule sets that deal with the quantitative aspects, and then there are those things in law. Law is somewhat, I mean, there's principles behind the law, but the law as drafted tends to be interpreted based on either precedent or the specific instances in which it came to be, right? So those things, the way that the law is kind of described should be in a manner that can be embodied in the system itself. And that's somewhat subject to the technology that's available to do what Sandy was describing as inference, what David was sort of alluding to, right? The technology's there, we just haven't used it to have these legal aspects, interpretive stuff of law, right? And its qualitative aspects that have been embodied in the system.
Well, I was saying that if we're going to the data area or any of the others, one of the things we need to think about is on steps going forward is when do we engage with the formal law processes? There's a certain set of these things that we can do informally. There's a certain set of these things we can get the consortia of the players to do. Your Higgins project is some degree of the consortia of the players. But at least some of these problems, particularly the data sharing one and the data ownership one, I think may not be fully solvable by contracting among willing parties. I think that there's a certain stage where you need to engage the actual formal lawmakers. I suggested some people, you know, is it time to start talking to the folks in Congress and the Senate about this? And a number of people went, we're going to get terrible stuff if we do that. Well, yeah, but on the other hand, you've got nothing at a certain level until you do. So I
Can I build on that? Because there was a different kind of discussion going on. When Dave was talking about control and ownership and law, and then shaking your head saying no way. I mean, if what may be the various legal mechanisms and other mechanisms whereby people are able to assert some kind of control over data about them, or how do you create accountability? Is that not a question that was on the table that it wasn't very satisfactorily answered? I mean,
going to be federal general privacy legislation.
I've been talking to programmers recently, and they tell me, it's just programming in the sense, if you describe it to me well, I can make it happen. The same is true to some degree of lawyers. I mean, if you describe it to me well, I can draft a statute, provided somebody will pass it, that will implement that rule set. But either you got to go into that, that's one of the reasons I was talking about that where law comes from. Some of it we can do peer-to-peer, but some of this we may have to eventually root into an actual legislation of a real lawmaking body or an international lawmaking body, and one of the questions is, when do you start talking to them?
Well, this suggests an actual core piece of research, which is the question of mutual sovereignty between the individual and the social organism. And right now, it seems to me like in the history of humanity, almost is sort of bouncing back and forth between, is the freedom of the individual paramount, or is the collective what matters most? And cultures come out on different sides of that. But somehow, it feels like we may be at a turning point where we can actually implement mutual sovereignty, where neither party gets the upper hand. And to me, it would seem like that would be a key aspect of the law lab.
Corporation.
I agree with that, points towards exploring the use of currencies to encourage, enable collective action. But I'm also thinking about Michael Walter's work in Spheres of Justice and the discussions at the State of Play conference, always on the magic circle. The question of when currencies function most effectively because they can't cross boundaries, I think, is an important question.
Yes. That's crucial. That's a key piece.
But how do we frame that as a research question?
And boundaries in a broad sense, right?
Yeah.
And that shouldn't be surprising, because if all of this boils down to organisms and systemics, right, a system is something that has a boundary within a greater whole. And we have all this nesting up and up and down, so the boundary key is central. And there's flows that occur inside a system, and then the question of flows between systems, relationships between the systems, and then new systems that emerge out of that, which is the creative potential of these things. How do we actually enable the systems themselves to generate new possibility?
So how would you design experiments or research around that? Should that be something?
Try two, in very small contexts, try two variations, one with that opens up the door to close.
To do currency experiments of some kind.
Yeah.
That seems to be surfacing.
I just think that there's a whole, I mean, I don't know, maybe in the law circles this isn't true, at least in the commerce circles I'm in, I think that there's not even a worldview that understands the evolution of currency and exchange yeah. and value. I mean, it's just a, there's kind of like a critical review of how these things, you know, just, there is nothing, you know, I don't think Niall Ferguson's thing does it.
No, that's right,
I agree. The, you know, right. it's, there is no Al Chandler of currency. Okay, there's nobody who's kind of like documented the evolution of this stuff and you know what the mechanisms are. I mean, Joel's pretty close, but you know what I mean. I mean, there's just no way to think about this stuff. I mean, in addition, I mean, I'm not saying that instead of the experiments, but in addition to.
Well, but there's a real concept of designing currencies around social purposes, right?
Yeah.
Being able to run experiments to do that as a form of social.
Well, what I'm saying is that there's no bridge between that and. You know, Bank of America and, you know, the, I mean, but tell me if you think that's true. I mean, between the credit issuers and the legislature.
Because you can't treat it like a mechanism. You have to create conditions under which.
There's likely to never be any incentive for there to be that.
It's got to be
emergent to the point where it moves the market itself. It will be held back. I mean, PayPal's a fine example of that. It will always be held back because of the disruption and because it's pulling off certain carve-offs of profits. So there will never be an incentive to make it happen.
And there are also wild experiments going on at the moment. I'm not sure we need to stay on its own. I mean, there are things, the Second Life and Linden Dollar, you know, if you want to do currency stuff, there is practice out there that if you surveyed everything from airlines to everything else, and there probably is a bunch of studies out there that I'm not aware of that you are on how these things behave.
Well, I don't know too much out of the academic world, but there is a huge amount. I was going to say that there's a huge amount of stuff in the wild that's going on that people are, and to me, part of it is actually beginning to see what we already do and realizing that they are currencies like grades, credits, and degrees. I'm sure there's somebody who's done a PhD study on the different formats and rule structures for grading students and what the results are. Now that's actually a perfect study about how these formal token systems actually change well-being. But understanding that as a one of a class of entities in the larger family of currencies, that is the new thing that people aren't saying is the case, and so maybe there needs to be some documentation of that. But you can certainly study how people have done a lot of these formal token systems without thinking of them as currencies.
So there's anything else that...
And you probably already have this on the docket, but just going back to the digital corporation, is just doing some more stuff on how to actually get the bank interaction to work with the real bank. And I don't know, we should just spend some time talking about that, because I think there's a lot of different ways to go at that.
Yeah.
And it might not be in the U.S., it might be something completely different, but...
Bahamas?
China?
The Stanford Bank?
Yeah.
I don't know, there'd be some law firms that would burn some associate time since they've got a surplus of that, speaking of currencies.
that's right.
It might be interesting to see whether we can find a major law firm or two that we're willing to think about some of that.
Yeah. Anything else?
Well,
yes, Court, please.
Just to come back to the point about data and massive amounts of it and how we secure it, loans and all that kind. But I think one of the interesting things to think about is what demand there is to protect that data. I mean, it's one thing for sort of a bunch of sophisticated academics and lawyers and technologists to think about it. It's another thing to say, you know, what are people outside of a group like this thinking about it? And on the consumer side, there's all kinds of issues about if they understand what they're thinking about and what they did. On the kind of business institutional side, you know, what trade-offs are they making, are they willing to make? And I think, you know, one interesting project is to really see what the demand is that people have good knowledge about the data problems that we've been talking about. And then once we identify those problems and create a demand or identify a demand to fix it, what would you want the law to do? What more?
Right.
And then you have the problem trying to harmonize conflicting laws of those kinds of issues.
All right, with that, I think
One more, all right.
Back on the identity aspect, the comments you made about multiple identities earlier. Interesting area of research might be in that frame. How would you support multiple identities? How would you, under what circumstances can you break those differences and merge them in? Obviously, for tax purposes, the government wants your total income. They don't want it broken down so that you get an income tax credit, earned income credit for six different incomes. But can you have contractual identities that are independent of each other? And for how long? Mm-hmm. Probably not in English, but maybe up to a certain point. It seems like there might be a rich field to think into.
Well, I mean, if that were important to you, one of the things that I would do is, if you were my client, is I would set you up three different single owner LLCs, each one of which would operate as a different contracting agent. I mean, we can't necessarily do it in marital relations, but we can do it in commercial relations, to have multiple identities in the United States.
But not just the commercial relationships, but also, Facebook.
True, yeah.
Yeah, because one of the things that we were talking about is the ability to take identity back and make it just as contextual as it needs to be and just as organic as it needs to be, which means basically having fractured charts and being able to aggregate into different personas. Like there's the business persona, and then there's the personal persona, and there's different things along those lines, and being able to have a certain amount of control over that when you present it. And then also in New Zealand, you actually have actual different identities, not even personas, where you can completely, and a lot of that's because of the whole criminal aspect, but being able to completely reinvent yourself. And it does actually have some really interesting legal aspects, and they're like lucky that things are very homogenous there. But they do actually have an identity verification system that handles those negative aspects. So.
Does anyone know what any studies or anything want on about why so few people change their names? I mean, aside from, say, a life event like getting married, and that's probably declining anyway. But it seems like very few people actually go in and change their names.
It's funny, though, because on the internet, I wouldn't necessarily always say that that's true, because we do fracture into many different personas. In fact, I'm unusual in that I only have one. Most people are kind of shocked that I'm at Salona everywhere. Because, in Burning Man, people have their playa names on IRC chat channels. They also have their unique identifying names. And there's a lot of people that I only know in context of their names. When I run into them, I'm like, hi, Enigma. I can't remember your real name. And if I say that in the wrong context, I actually fracture his personas and merge them together in inappropriate situations. But there are that kind of thing that is starting to happen, and you're actually finding young people on Facebook purposely doing that, and they're trying to fly underneath the radar right now, and so they can create personas where they have their normal one, which mom and dad friend, and then they go and create, other ones that look real but aren't quite real, so that they can get away from mom, dad, and, Aunt Bertha.
I think this is based in the anthropology that playing kind of a mimicry and means to change your identity, come out of your person into another one. And this is a basic setup for life, I think. It's embedded in the human nature.
Just to keep it?
No.
Oh,
change
just it. To change it.
But yeah, but to keep the attribute.
Yeah.
Just one more thing that occurred to me that when we started out talking about cloud computing and other, there's all in the wiki there's an open cloud manifesto and part of the interest is, and we're talking about a transformation is going to happen in clouds whereby if people have mobile identities and they can mash up and they're themselves in their own cloud and have portability of them. I mean, how important is that? I mean, it strikes me that, and you don't have proprietary protocols that limit you from having data mobility. I mean, is this something that people think is important, or is this sort of, and things like Hadoop and all this is going on to open up the cloud?
Mm-hmm. Well, that's the whole reason for, going through and acknowledging that.
Jim, there's a little switch on that you can throw.
I know.
Yeah. point decrement.
He's really getting to the negative points here. But that's why, you know, wanting to sit there and have something in regards to the multiple ownership of data, because we do need to figure out, you know, my whole thing is how do we do the person to organization, organization to organization to person sharing of data, and what are all the handshakes that actually have to take place for that to happen. Because, you know, like the example that I was given 5 years ago is the Christian Coalition and Move On wanted to get their membership together to work on a wiki about net neutrality. But none of them wanted to give me their lists, right? And there was only a certain amount of information that they wanted to exchange, but I had professional facilitators on the wikis, and so I did want to bring over a fair amount of personality information so that the facilitators could make sure that everyone always presented a human face, because flaming happens a lot less when you, the more persona information you put on there, the less likely people are to flame each other. And the professional facilitators really wanted to have a fair amount of that. And how do you broker those kinds of deals is a difficult question.
So you're saying being able to develop one of the protocols for the handshakes and be able to end result? Because that would seem
and
to
creating
be
those trust relationships and like having some of that data expire, having, you know, different, having it very codified in regards to what information is brought over, what information isn't, things of that nature. And also creating that in such a way so that users can honestly understand it is like the really hard part. You know, I was joking with her, I'm like, I want a paranoid setting, I'm completely transparent setting, and oh God, would you please tell me what the norm might be?
Well, one of the things we think about at Higgins really is you may have sort of icons representing different sort of policies people stand behind. You know, I'm totally paranoid about this. This is my medical, and I'm totally lax. And that's you adhere to those sets of principles. You make it very, very simple.
Yeah, because I might be really transparent about LinkedIn because it's my professional stuff.
Right.
But on Tribe, which is Burning Man, I'm not going to be as open on that one, for example.
I don't know if this is
One of the things I'd love if you guys would do is that I wish you'd basically do the social equivalent of war games, which is, you know, I for one believe within the next 20 years we're going to have a killer virus. It's going to be H1N1 2, and we're much more fragile as a society than we were in 1918 because we've got fewer people on the farms, we've got fewer buffers in the system, there's much more interdependence. I would love if you guys could just figure out, okay, how do you guys, we've just nuked, you know, pick your poison. I mean, you know, we've broken the society in these three ways, and how are you going to reorganize yourselves? If you could do that, it'd be cool.
I just led a panel Sunday in D.C. with a whole bunch of the crisis responders and DHS and DOD about how do we do gaming for crisis education, preparedness, all those different things. There's one really neat example out there, which is called Superstruct, which is Jane McGonigal. It's a futures sort of group, and everyone's actually supposing as to, it's amazing if you go and look at it. If you just Superstruct, if you go and Google it, you'll see it. And it's amazing the fun that people are having in regards to creating these scenarios. They like age themselves. And so it's 20 years later, and da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da, and they're doing these different little videos and, like, you know, sketching out all these different disaster scenarios and things of that nature and, you know, creating a whole game about it. And then, like, one of the ones that I suggested is I want Facebook badges. I want Girl Scout badges for preparedness. Uh-huh. So what I could do is I can go in and, you know, prepare, you know, my emergency kit, go to the fire department, have a fireman on my Facebook go, yep. And then I get a little badge.
That's
on
a currency.
Facebook.
It is.
You know,
right.
Doing,
I mean,
you know,
it incentivizes behavior, and all of a sudden you've got a different world.
I know a guy who consults for them on swine flu, and they're doing all kinds of developing disaster modeling and things like that. Again, it's not widely distributed, but at least the folks there are doing a bunch of that.
So there's two. I mean, I want to make sure I understand what you're saying. So one way to do it is to, system dynamic modeling, and the other way is to actually create a system by which real people get on there. Are you suggesting both or one?
Or I mean, you couldn't do this, but as a thought experiment, you know, basically you break the social hierarchy and rule system of Harvard Law School, all coordination mechanisms, everything, and you know people are there for a week trying to figure out how to put it all back together, you know, but they still have to get their classes done. They still have to, you know what I mean? So you break it and say, okay, how much can you really self-organize yourself around
the
task?
Right, but wouldn't you first try to model what currently exists and make sure that that's totally understood?
Sure.
Because a lot of times it's not exactly what people think it is, and what it really is not the same.
Exactly, both.
Okay.
Yeah. But I'm worried that if you just do the first one, you really don't know how it works.
So one...
We'll do a wrap up.
Okay. One quick thing is a generalization that I heard a couple people talk about that might be really interesting is on the necessity of forgetting in the cloud,
mm-hmm.
and how important that is. I mean, we heard Sandy talk about it, you talked about
yeah.
it, but there are other, and in the currency world, it's also important, and there actually may be a really important role in what the rules are of forgetting. Because forgetting may actually be something that is a something that actually helps organisms to survive.
Yeah, well, that's like the whole letting certain data expire after certain points. You know, we're going to have a whole group of young people that, even though everyone says there's going to be a certain amount of tolerance, that's going to be a long change. And they're going to want to forget some stuff.
And that ties into your multiple identities, too.
Right, because we need to be able to have.
An example of what you would be forgetting.
My tattoos?
The pictures.
That you're drunken, weekend,
oh my God.
Donkey.
Oh yeah, yeah.
But I mean, it's the same thing as having your account wiped.
That's a good one. Pretty specific.
Or what is it? Your.
Where do I find that?
Your.
Oh yeah,
tape. This last point, it's worth noting that there's a forthcoming book by colleague of ours, Victor Meyer Schoenberger, and he wrote a book actually on forgetting in cyberspace. From my side, just probably when we want to wrap up. Or
no, go ahead. I was just thinking, really.
So, this is a lot of homework for us, obviously, and a very rich agenda and very rich proposals. So, thank you very much for this. If you look at the agenda, there is one other person listed actually for this wrap up session, which is of course, I hoped, right, that
you kept looking down when I looked at it. His head was always I was counting eye contact. It was
the way I like to frame it, and that's probably helpful just by way of background. You know, Willy and a group of other colleagues in Switzerland are working together with us to explore whether we want to submit a large grant proposal to one of the institutions in Switzerland that funds research, basic research. And one of the things we tried to figure out in our discussions has been, it seems plain that, you know, there are technologists and they think about cloud computing in their terms, and there's a bunch of lawyers and policy people, they talk about this stuff in their language and with their concepts, and we could continue, right? Go with the economists and, you know, people obsessed with identity systems and so forth. And the question, though, is if you think about the research agenda, how do we really create an integrated research agenda? And of course, the law lab on our side of the Atlantic now is very much an attempt across various themes to design and experiment with integrated, real interdisciplinary research agendas. So my question to you, Will, having this background now and listening to all these conversations over today, what's your takeaway in terms of interaction points, connection points, intersections that may be helpful while we, think further the possibilities of a truly interdisciplinary research proposal in cloud computing?
Well, I think the experiments are an important part of that, to create scenarios, work through them both from the technological end and from the policy regulatory end and see where that leads and sort of iterate through them. I think that's definitely a possibility. I must say, I sort of too much of this conversation sort of felt a little bit out of my league. I mean, much of the lingua that sort of you speak is meaningless to me. I think equally, if I were to speak my lingua, it would be, you know, meaningless to many of you. I think that's definitely an important, I don't know whether we need a book of clouds for dummies or something like that, clouds for technologists or clouds for lawyers, but I think there's definitely a lingual problem that I found hard to get over. That may be another sort of point where, I mean, certainly if we get to this proposal is to sort of have an educational component, I think, that tries to bridge that gap. And engineers don't know this, and lawyers don't know the engineering part either. I think it's important to understand both. So I think, like many of the things that were discussed, like identity, I mean, I think it has both components, right? You have to sort of know what can be done technologically, and you have to know what you want to do policy-wise, and if you don't understand each other's language, it's a meaningless conversation.
Yeah. We're supposed to be out of the slot room by 5 o'clock, so
okay.
A little bit
over. But I want to thank everybody for the participation and coming, and I hope we continue the conversation. We're having a website, putting stuff up. We want to engage you on an ongoing basis, so please.
Thank you.